All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And this next interview is going to be something else. Blew me away. The article is by Brian Bender at Boston.com, from the Pentagon to the private sector. Welcome to the show, Brian. How are you doing?
Good. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. Excellent work. I want to start with some of what you found here at the very top of the article here. The Globe analyzed the career paths of 750 of the highest-ranking generals and admirals who retired during the last two decades. What'd you find there?
Well, what we found is that the share of the most senior military officers who leave the military and very quickly go to work for the private defense industry has grown substantially over the last 20 years, from less than 50% to around 80%, and in some recent years, even closer to 90%.
Nearly 90%, it says here, 34 out of 39 three- and four-star generals and admirals who retired in 2007 are now working in defense roles, nearly 90% defense roles, meaning working for private companies that have contracts with the Pentagon.
Right.
Amazing. Okay. Now, I don't know if I should skip, you know, hold this till the end or what, but it just seems to me like sort of the overall feel of this article is that what you found is that this is no longer scandalous, that back even, you know, I don't know, early 90s or something, everybody kind of knew that there's all this corruption and military-industrial complex, revolving door, iron triangle type, whatever you call it. But it was always at least, you know, kind of embarrassing, and we don't talk about that like the crazy aunt or whatever, right? But now it's just, oh, yeah, that's the way it works is, you know, first you're a general, and then you get to go make a real living reaching your hand into the U.S. Treasury.
Right. Well, one of the things we found that was troubling to many knowledgeable observers, including some retired generals and admirals themselves, is that you don't just have this sort of conveyor belt, if you will, that leaves the Pentagon and virtually every senior officer gets on it and goes into the defense industry, but you also have this blurring of the lines. In other words, these same generals, in many cases that we documented, are consulting for defense companies or, you know, in some cases, working directly for them as a top executive, but they are also still in official capacities advising the military, brought back in to run a study, to sit on a commission, a panel. So in many cases, you have these retired generals who are continuing to help shape what the Pentagon's priorities are, what kinds of technologies it's investing in or should invest in, at the same time that it's being paid by the same defense companies that would presumably benefit from that investment. And that's what's been most troubling to people, is not just simply that you have a lot of generals now, the vast majority of them going to work for munitions manufacturers. That is troubling in and of itself, but more troubling is this idea that they're playing both sides, that that in a system that is sort of rife with conflicts of interest, but has become widely accepted within the institution. In fact, one of the things we found is that these guys, and increasingly women as well, who reach this level in the military, that they are brought out to San Diego sometimes a year and a half or 2 years before they retire, where they're given these career seminars, which basically teaches them how to network in the defense industry. And in some cases, we found generals who had actually established their own consulting firms before they retired. It didn't necessarily mean they were consulting while they were still in uniform, but, you know, it certainly raises questions about their independence while they were still in uniform, if they're already figuring out, you know, where can I get private clients?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. It reminds me of that phrase that they use in the counterinsurgency where they talk about the self-licking ice cream cone, where you just you create a policy and then that creates the reason for further and further escalation. And it seems like one of the things that's changed, especially over the last 10 years, but I guess you can clarify in your 20-year timeline here that you're covering, the outsourcing more and more of policy. It's not just making the weapons. It's actually the companies are brought in to basically serve as the deputy secretaries of things there, and to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, it's the think tanks, I guess, are part of it all too, but it, you know, it's one big mesh, right? Northrop Grumman and Lockheed and the think tanks and the generals all sort of working on this big conveyor belt, I guess, as you call it.
Right. Well, that's, you know, it's sort of like the old adage, what's wrong with Washington is not what's illegal, it's what's legal.
Yeah.
And I think this is a perfect example of that, where you sort of have a system that has grown up over many decades that perhaps in the last decade, particularly since 9/11, when the spigot has just been wide open in terms of defense spending, where things have gotten out of control. And, you know, it's not that generals and admirals haven't historically gone to work for defense interests. That's, you know, been a fairly steady history, you know, going back to the post-World War II era. You know, Howard Hughes was famous for trying to pluck, you know, the most brilliant retired general coming out of uniform to help him build his next airplane. But what we found is that, you know, in recent decades, you have this different phenomenon where generals get out and they aren't going to work directly for these defense companies, but consulting for them. And that tends to be selling access, selling their Rolodex, setting up meetings, opening doors, gathering information, because in many cases they still have security clearances, they still sit on these advisory panels, which give them an opportunity to have insight into the Pentagon's deliberations and help their clients as a result. And what struck me about this as I did my research was the number of retired generals and admirals. And certainly they are in the minority, but there are a number of them out there who have raised, you know, very serious concerns about this trend. And they worry not just that you have conflicts of interest, you have, you know, defense companies in some ways kind of commercializing the senior military, but they worry that it has a potential impact on people still in uniform. In other words, you're the retired general, you come back into the Pentagon shopping your wares or representing your private industry client that's paying you, you know, boatloads of money, and you go in and make a pitch to potentially a general still in uniform who used to work for you, or perhaps got promoted because you were his mentor when you were still in uniform. And some of the retired generals and admirals I talked to worry that that's a corrosive dynamic for the current officer corps, because over time you sort of have this system potentially where everybody sees the riches on the other side. They see where they're going. And the worry is that that could somehow affect or cloud their judgment while they're still in uniform, where they're supposed to be independent, give independent advice to the political leaders of the country. So again, you know, I think it's the broad trend that has worried people. It's not necessarily the individual generals, because I think, you know, you talk to them and they maintain that they're very ethical, they have integrity, that's why they served in the military for so many years, you know, in some cases 3 or 4 decades. But it's when you take the step back and you look at the broader system, you know, as you put it, the self-licking ice cream cone, I think it's a phenomenon that people are starting to ask questions about. Is this healthy, particularly since it's not very open to the public?
Right. You know, if you're a consultant, and we're talking about $1 trillion a year here.
Right, and if
that's
you're a
not messing around.
If you're a consultant, you don't have to, you know, divulge who your clients are or you know, who you're meeting with in the Pentagon. And, you know, there are some members of Congress who are starting to make calls for some more disclosure, at least so that the public
actually, hold that thought right there. Hold that thought right there, Brian. We're going to pick it right back up with Brian Bender from the Boston Globe, talking about the generals and their dollars after this. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Brian Bender. He is a staff writer at the Boston Globe, boston.com. His newest piece, I guess newest, biggest, most recent, From the Pentagon, to the private sector is there at boston.com. And I want to ask you, Brian, about a lot more of the specifics, the examples that you cite in the article and that kind of thing. But I sort of wanted to still touch on sort of the larger question about the change of things. I sort of have a picture in my head of some kind of old, like, World War II era newsreel footage about how the titans of industry answer Uncle Sam's call to turn their plowshares into swords for the defense of freedom and whatever. But it's sort of like a reluctant thing. They're being taken away from their lives for the good of their plans for their businesses, for the good of the country temporarily or something. And yet it seems now that the policy is, you know, pretty much not really approved by, you know, in any of these wars by the majority of the American people, but they just sort of go on and on forever because, I guess those people who answered Uncle Sam's call, you know, never came home. They're still pushing the very same program as though it was the 1940s.
Well, I mean, I think it gets to this broader point that, actually I interviewed, retired General Wesley Clark, who obviously, you know, as a presidential candidate in 2004. And his take on it was that, you know, one of the reasons why you have these retired generals in such high demand at defense companies, and as we also documented in some cases, these private equity firms that hire the generals to help them figure out, you know, what kinds of companies to invest in that are likely to get lots of Pentagon dollars in the future. Clark thinks that it's part of what he called the militarization of the American economy, that with a manufacturing base that has gotten smaller and smaller, and is, you know, as we've seen it all, a lot of manufacturing go overseas, one of the remaining sectors that is doing well and therefore is worth investing in is the national security sector, whether it's defense or homeland security. And you know, I think that is one reason why the generals are in such high demand. And, you know, I think one other point I would make on this is just that my sense is that this broader phenomenon is really more about the defense companies swallowing the generals than it is the generals, you know, getting ready to retire after 35 years and, you know, trying to, you know, figure out how do I cash in, how do I make the quickest buck. I think there are generals who are like that. They're angling to get out so they can go off and make $1 million. But I think the vast majority of them, you know, as one compared it to, it's sort of like the NFL draft. They get near retirement or they get out of uniform and all of a sudden there's a flurry of offers coming from Northrop Grumman and General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin, and we'll give you stock and we'll pay you this and we'll cover that. And, you know, for a guy or a girl who has spent 35 years in the military, most of that career not making a lot of money, in many cases, you know, I was sort of surprised that a lot of these retired generals get out and they don't even own a home because they were moved around every 2 years with their family and they always rented. And so, you know, I think the defense companies know that. They value the information and, you know, in many cases, like I said, the Rolodex of these guys, and it's sort of irresistible. In some cases to go work for these guys. So, you know, it gets to this broader point that you're raising, which is war is big business and, you know, money talks, and it's kind of hard for some of these guys to say no, even though they know in the back of their minds, well, you know, I don't really want to sell weapons. That's doesn't really agree with me. But, you know, I think in a lot of the cases they find that, you know, as they go into this new world of the private sector, they sort of forget that. And, you know, they sort of rationalize it in their head that what they're doing is beneficial to the country. That, you know, hey, I'm helping these defense contractors build things that the troops need. Mm-hmm. And I think where some people have concerns is that there's a lot of cases where it's not clear that what these defense contractors are building and the Pentagon is buying is necessarily what the troops need.
Right. You know, it seems to me, I read this thing, I actually interviewed the author of it, a guy, I can't remember his first name, Bond Graham was his last name. He's from the Los Alamos Study Group, and he wrote this thing criticizing the START Treaty for all the goodies for the Republicans that were thrown in to get it passed and that kind of thing. And but he had this really long, in-depth article, and a big part of it dealt with all the lobbying by the hydrogen bomb manufacturing firms for more money and more factories and, you know, billions and billions of dollars that go into our hydrogen bomb capacity when we already got a lot of hydrogen bombs. And who needs hydrogen bombs? And it seems like, you know, it's I'm disappointed, I guess, in my fellow American citizens who run these companies that they don't reluctantly make hydrogen bombs as long as Uncle Sam demands that he really needs some. They're actually pushing for a policy that says that America must have a bunch of hydrogen bombs because that's their business. I mean, there's got to be some morality, you know, that trumps profit when it comes to, and especially when it's all tax money anyway, you know? I don't know. I just, it's really bad. It's like, the tick getting so big that it threatens to destroy us, you know?
You know, it's interesting. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary. January 17th will be 50 years since President and General Eisenhower gave his famous farewell address in which he warned about the unchecked power and influence of the military-industrial complex. Well, it turns out that originally, as they were drafting that speech, the term was actually military-industrial congressional complex, and it was shortened for whatever reason by one of the speechwriters before that speech. And I think that's a big piece of this. It's the Congress. We all know the stories of all the defense programs that get funded in this state or that state because they mean jobs. And I think that the Congress is as much to blame, if not more so, than, you know, any element of our government in letting the defense industry dictate, in many cases, what the nation buys and what the nation spends on defense. It's the Constitution that gives the Congress the power of the purse. And, you know, there's very few cases where Congress says no to a weapons system. And the contractors know that. I mean, they put out these advertisements that show that, I think it was the F-22 fighter jet when that was on the chopping block. They put out a big ad campaign that talks about how it's built in 44 states and 95,000 jobs at stake. I mean, they're very shrewd about getting to members of Congress and, you know, convincing them that if they vote no on this, they're basically going to be sending, you know, pink slips to their constituents. So, you know,
too bad they don't read Frederick Bastiat. Seems like, you know, that money could be spent on productive uses instead of just machines of destruction. But I guess, you know, it's all aggregate demand in the world of the military economy. But so hang on one second here, because as we only have a couple minutes left, I wanted to give you a chance to tell us about General Keane and the Humvee, if you could, because he's a pretty famous and influential guy. He helped get the Iraq surge through and all that.
Yeah, Jack Keane is a retired vice chief of staff in the Army, so the Army's number two. I think he's been out of uniform about 7 years now, and he is probably one of the most influential retired generals. He was a mentor to Dave Petraeus, who is the commander now in Afghanistan. When Petraeus was in Iraq, as you pointed out, Keane had a very influential role in crafting the surge of U.S. troops into Iraq in 2007. He sits on something called the Defense Policy Board, which is a senior advisory panel that advises the Secretary of Defense. But he also has a lot of defense industry clients, and one of them is the company that owns AM General, the maker of the Humvee. And one of the cases that we were able to uncover to demonstrate the influence some of these generals, retired generals, have was how earlier this year the Army had decided that it didn't want to build Humvees anymore. It had plenty of them, and that it would shift some of the funding to refurbishing the fleet that it already had. So the Humvees come back from Iraq or Afghanistan and they get upgraded instead of being replaced. It was cheaper, and the Army thought it could save money that way. So, but that program or that plan didn't go very far because AM General had Jack Keane and a couple of other retired Army generals as part of their sort of power trio that leaned on the Army, that leaned on some members of Congress, and in the end...
We got to leave it there. I'm sorry, Brian. Thank you so much for your time. It's Brian Bender, everybody, from Boston.com, the Boston Globe, from the Pentagon to the private sector. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
See you all tomorrow.